Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. We're here in the Main Street studio. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we are grateful that you are spending time with us today. Coming up in just a bit, in Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern takes us to Australia's Barossa Valley, where jacaranda trees bloom purple and German Prussian heritage echoes across wine country. We also mark Veterans Day with the story of Army pilot Garrett Illebrand, a North Dakotan severely injured in Iraq. And we look at farmers across the Midwest who say the labor crisis for them is deepening. Many are urging Washington to make it easier to hire foreign workers legally. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and at Riding for Dreams in Lisbon, horses do much more than trot and canter. They help people of all ages build strength, confidence, and connection. The nonprofit provides adaptive riding and equine-assisted therapy for children and adults with physical, emotional, or developmental challenges. Joining us is Crystal Carlaccio. She's the organization's executive director. She'll share how it all began and what these remarkable animals can teach us about healing and hope. Crystal, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that Riding for Dreams offers individualized learning with horses to unlock each person's unique potential and create caring communities. Can you describe for us how that mission came to be and what prompted the idea?
Yes. In 2009, there was three amazing women who came together and all had equine experience and some healthcare experience and had a passion for helping. It started with kids, helping kids with disabilities connect to the healing spirit of horses. And so in 2009, Riding for Dreams became the first adaptive therapy program with equines in the state of North Dakota. So we're very proud of that, and we've been running ever since with summer lessons, fall lessons, and sometimes we get spring lessons, and in the future we'd like to expand that to winter lessons with our indoor arena. Lonnie Rotenberger was one of the founders, along with Lori Bischoff and Stacy Erdman.
How did you arrive at the name Riding for Dreams? What does dreams mean in this context, and how do you see horses helping people chase or achieve their dreams?
So I think that the big component in today's world is finding things that you're passionate about to refill your own cup so that you can continue to help yourself and help others and have a passion for life. And so these women knew that they had a passion for riding horses and for spreading that love of horses. And they had also seen positive physical and emotional attributes when putting that with healthcare and therapies. And so that is where the Riding for Dreams came in, to try to better each child's life, whether they have a physical disability, a learning disability, an emotional disability, a behavioral disability, just anything to bring a positive attribute to embracing and helping make their, whether it's physical disability better and emotional state better.
Take us into a typical lesson, if you would, Crystal. How do you adapt for kids of different ages, different abilities, maybe even different goals?
Yes, we have two instructors right now, Lonnie Rotenberger and Rachel Waddell. And they both meet with the students before lessons and their families. We have applications that need to be filled out. And then, of course, some provider doctor releases just to make sure everything is safe. Most students can ride horses. There are a few exceptions where if they've had certain surgeries or certain equipment for their health that we do groundwork. Where they get to brush and connect with the horse and cuddle with the horse and lead the horse and do things on the ground. And then the riding, we have different saddles. We have different harnesses. We have a Sir single, it's called. And this last couple of years is my first experience with the Sir single personally. But it's not a saddle.
Yeah.
So it's a leather, it goes around the girth of the horse, which if you look at the horses right behind their front legs, and you tighten it, and it has like a hexagon handle so that these kids can really grab hold, but they also have that contact with the actual horse instead of the saddle. And so there's no saddle, it's just the handle, and then we do have sidewalkers, but actually it improves the posture of almost all the kids. With the Sir Single, it seems like all the kids get that benefit.
Crystal, you highlight that your horses have individual names like Jake and Yeller and Prince and Naughty. I'm not sure I'd want to ride Naughty, but Junior. And I'm sure every horse has their own personality. How important are the horses themselves in the therapeutic process, and how do you select and train them for this kind of work?
Yes, a lot goes into finding horses. There's great horses in the world, but not all of them are great therapy horses. They have to have a really laid-back personality. They have to go with the flow, and they have to be very trainable. And with the names, the funny thing is that it's superstitious to change a horse's name. That's why Naughty is still called Naughty, but he's not Naughty at all. So it's kind of a superstition not to change his name. But he did have a lot of spunk when he was younger. So I think that's probably where he got that name from.
Where do you find them?
So we have been really fortunate with people donating horses. We have bought a few, and we are always looking for new horses to add to our program. But we have Prince was bought, and then we are allowed to use him. He was donated to our program. He is actually 25 years young, which is quite old for a horse. So he is getting close to retirement. But he is actually one of, I'd say, the more spirited personalities we have. He is so funny because with adults, he likes to kind of play practical jokes on you. He likes to kind of nudge you, and he kind of is a pest to adults. But he changes dramatically when he is partnered with his students. And so he loves his students and does not do that to them at all. But when I lead him, he's a pest.
Do you develop almost like curriculums for people that you serve and try to figure out how you can best serve them? How does that process work for you?
Yes, our instructors, Lonnie and Rachel, meet with the students before the lessons start, and they create individualized plans for each child. And now we do adults as well. And they take in the fact, like if they have vision impairments, they put that into the lessons. And each kid and adult has goals that we're striving for. So whether it's to build more confidence to do things independently, or whether it's to work on our anxiety and impulse control, or whether it's to work on our hand dexterities, or even our core strengths throughout the lessons. And even just the muscles with getting on and off the horse independently. We are lucky enough to have a ramp that we can use with students who are more physically disabled and not able to get on without the ramp. And Yeller is actually our ramp horse right now. So he helps us, and he is a great horse, but he, of course, is 22 as well. So he's getting up there too.
So does your location in Lisbon... It's far away from larger communities like Jamestown or even Fargo, of course, or Bismarck. For those that are wondering, it's kind of, I guess, south and west of Fargo and south and east of Jamestown. Does that make it problematic, or are you as busy as you would like to be?
Yeah, right now we actually have a waiting list. We would love to find more instructors. So if anybody has a passion for whether it's healthcare, teaching, equine, we're always looking for that. But yeah, we try to get every student into. We do have students that come from Wahpeton. We have students that come from Grand Forks. We used to have students from Jamestown, and there is a program that started in Jamestown now in the last few years. We have students from Valley City, Oaks, Gwinner. There's
just from a lot of
probably
places.
About 50 different students. Yeah.
Wow. How do they learn about you?
We try to do as much word of mouth, a Facebook page I've gotten up and running in the last year or so here. trying to reach out Facebook. I've gone to some events just to help spread the word. We've done fundraisers in McLeod and Lisbon. We have reached out to some like social services or like open door community centers. But I think a lot of it's just word of mouth in the small communities.
We're enjoying our conversation with Crystal Carlaccio. She's the executive director of Writing for Dreams, which is a nonprofit in Lisbon helping North Dakotans grow and heal through adaptive writing. Crystal, I understand your donations cover about 79% of the cost of participant services. How do you balance accessibility for families, especially those with financial need, with program costs?
Yes, that has been increasingly challenging in the economic status, I'm sure that everybody is experiencing. But we have some amazing sponsors and just community support. So we are still able to have a scholarship program. And a lot of our students do benefit from that just because cost of travel, doctor's appointments, insurance costs, everything has just gone up so far. But that's also why we are doing more. We're doing bingo nights in McLeod every other Friday. We've done some meat raffles. We did a trail course. And then we also have our December 5th annual fundraiser coming up in McLeod. And so that's primarily my job to try to fund and continue the program, along with adding more instructors and horses and students.
Crystal, if you could you share with us maybe a couple success stories where lives have been meaningfully changed through Writing for Dreams?
Yes, I know of several different students whose parents have relayed. We had one student that was completely nonverbal and came and rode with us, our program, for a few sessions and said their first word, which had not happened for years. And the mom was completely taken back, and it was a really touching story.
That's awesome.
And then we have some behavioral students that when we first met with them, could not even sit down to even get through the induction. And with the help of our instructor, Lonnie, and some behavioral plans, they ride for up to a half hour and complete smiles the entire time and look forward to coming back. And the parents and school has told us how beneficial it's been for them. And even just strength, we've had students be able to stand. At first, they couldn't stand for even 5 minutes to pet on the horses. And by the end of our summer sessions, it can stand for up to 30 minutes.
Crystal, you mentioned that funding is kind of an ongoing challenge for you. What are other organizational challenges that you face, whether it's volunteers, whether it's facilities, horse care you talked about? How do you address those?
Yeah, we constantly are reaching out for more volunteers. We actually have some that have come from Fargo. And some workplaces will actually do a donation for the hours worked. So that's been very helpful for us. We use Sign Up Genius on our Facebook page to recruit and keep volunteers. And we try to give back to our volunteers as much as possible. So this winter in the riding arena, we're going to open it up so that volunteers can bring their own horses and utilize our facilities. And then at the annual fundraiser, we'll sponsor their meal and then just try to work with people in the community as much as we can.
If you were going to reach out to one new partner, let's say to join you next year, what kind of partner would you be looking for and what would you ask them to help you with?
We actually have some longtime board members that are retiring. So if anybody has an interest in helping the foundation and helping us run the foundation, that would be insanely helpful. If you don't even have to have an equine background, some of our board members have financial backgrounds, which is so helpful. Eventually, we would love to build on and have bathrooms on site for our riding arena. Right now, we just have a porta potty. So we do have a fund that's designated. I so far have $100,000 raised for that project. So any partners in that, we've been talking about naming rights. With that, if a business wanted to partner and have naming rights with the facility. But yeah, board members would be welcomed and building sponsors or just horse program. We have a Our horses cost about $5,400 a year for feed, vet bills, farrier care. Our older senior horses unfortunately need extra calories to keep weight. And then we are lucky enough to have a volunteer that exercises them all for us. So that is free. But everything else adds up.
Crystal, what drew you to this work personally? What's your story?
So I actually have my bachelor's degree in nursing and worked in Fargo. I've worked in Minot, Bismarck, and Lisbon Hospital. I actually got a 2-year contract with to repay some student loans. So that's how I ended up in the area. And then with healthcare, and I've had horses my whole life, I just happened upon the annual fundraiser that they had every year was a trail ride by the Fort Ransom. So I went to there. I was actually a rodeo queen at the time, so I helped them lead the trail ride. And it's all been a volunteer-ran business until last year. They came to the realization that they just needed someone to help full-time. So I applied for the job just because my background with nursing and patient care, and then also my love of equine and giving back to the community.
For families or individuals, Crystal, who are considering the program, maybe they're hearing about it for the first time, what advice or encouragement would you give them even before that first ride?
Yeah, they are always welcome to reach out. Our Facebook page is Riding for Dreams Adaptive Riding, or we do have a website, ridingfordreams.com. And then, or my personal contact information, I can give you as well. And but basically, they can reach out, they can come meet the horses, they can come to like a volunteer days, they don't have to commit to anything, they can come check us out, they can come talk to us, or just on the phone. I'd love to talk to them and find out if we are a good fit for them. And then, yeah, I'd say come to one of our events and just meet everybody. The paperwork, you just have to fill out a packet and then the doctor has to sign it. It's nothing too invasive. It's nothing too hard. That paperwork is good every year. And then there is a fee to hold their spot of $50. And then you can apply for the scholarship or you can pay for the classes.
Give us one more push for your fundraiser coming up here right after Thanksgiving, Crystal.
Yeah, December 5th, we are having our annual fundraiser. It's our first time with a December inside event. We used to have a trail ride, but now we are doing it in McLeod at Silver Prairie Saloon. It'll start at 5:30 with a social. There will be a steak supper included. We will have a silent auction. We are going to do free bingo games for prizes. Students will be there with their families so people can ask and talk to them. We're going to have volunteers there for recognition. The board will be there. It's going to be a really fun event. Diamonds and Denim is what we're calling it. So people can show up wearing their denim and participate and learn more.
My guest has been Crystal Carlaccio. She's the executive director of Riding for Dreams. It's based in Lisbon, and it helps North Dakotans grow up and heal through adaptive riding and equine therapy. Crystal, it has been a pleasure and best wishes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today in Plainsfolk, Dr. Tom Ezern takes us from Dakota Territory to the Barossa Valley of South Australia with a story of travel, heritage, Lutheran roots, and the human urge to follow curiosity wherever it leads.
We will arrive in the Barossa at Peak Jacaranda. Reviewing the sentence I just spoke, I realize I'm speaking gibberish as far as my neighbors in Dakota Territory are concerned, so I'll explain. Jacaranda is a genus of lavender-flowering trees native to South America. One particularly ornamental species of jacaranda, originating from Argentina and Bolivia, was introduced to Australia before 1850. The detail's indeterminate, but of course, Australians introduced all sorts of plants and animals that came back to bite them. Jacarandas, however, are a horticultural icon, heavily planted by towns and city landscapers, bedecking avenues with purple blossoms and a bewitching scent. Which brings me to the Barossa, a region of South Australia populated by German-speaking Prussians beginning in the 1840s. Such folk peopled the hill country of South Australia. At the same time, they also migrated to the hill country of central Texas. With a common result, both regions possess world-class vineyards and wineries. The Barossa, particularly, which is the unofficial capital of that sector of the New World wine industry devoted to the red wine known as Shiraz. The Germans of the Barossa also joined in the Australian passion for Jacaranda. So when Dr. Kelly and I travel later this month to the Barossa on a research junket, we will arrive at peak Jacaranda, seeing the country in spectacular blossom. It takes about 30 hours of travel time to get there. I remember about 15 years ago, a supper table conversation when my aged mother, knowing my reputation as a prairie historian, asked me, "Well, why do you have to travel to such faraway places for your work?" Meaning Australia, Norway, New Zealand, and so on. And I told her, "Mom, because I can." Well, she understood immediately. I wish now I could talk with her about the Jacaranda. And about Lutherans, to which subject she surely would warm. I come from a family of Missouri Synod German Lutherans, and the German folk of the Barossa are members of the Lutheran Church of Australia. A decade ago, Dr. K and I were nosing around the church compound of one of its churches, Bethany Lutheran of Tanunda, in the German-speaking, grape-growing heart of the Barossa. Parting the shrubbery in a corner of the lot, we read the inscription on a modest monument. In commemoration of the departure of the pioneer missionaries from Bethany, 22nd October, 1875, to establish the Hermannsburg Mission among the Aborigines in Central Australia. Unveiled, 19th October, 1975. The missionaries from the Barossa crossed half the continent to the Arenta Intaria settlement, where they founded the Hermannsburg Mission, which Dr. K and I had previously visited. They drove 2,200 sheep along with the horses, cattle, and goats from waterhole to waterhole through the desert. It was epic. The story is not without controversy, as historians, along with the public, have brought a critical eye to bear on missionaries and mission schools throughout the colonized world. It is still epic, if not purely valorous. We're going to begin our investigation of it at the starting point, and amid the Jacarandas of Tanunda, we'll attend Lutheran services at Bethany in 2 weeks. I'll let you know how it goes.
That was Plains Folk from Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. He continues to bring more stories of the people and places that shaped the Great Plains.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
Still to come on this Veterans Day, we share the story of Army Pilot Garrett Illibrand, a North Dakotan severely injured in a 2023 drone attack in Iraq. And a message to all of our veterans from Prairie Public 100 times over. We are thankful for your service. That's ahead on Main Street, right after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Finnish comedian Ismo to the Fargo Theater Sunday, November 16th. Named the quote-unquote funniest person in the world in a 2014 contest by The Laugh Factory, Ismo collaborated with Merriam-Webster on an English-language comedy series. Details at jadepresents.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and on this Veterans Day and in this holiday season, generosity meets gratitude. For the 14th consecutive year, the Bob and Renee Parsons Foundation and Parsons Extreme Golf are partnering with Semper Fi and America's Fund for the Double Down for Veterans Match campaign. Through the end of the year, every donation to the fund will be matched dollar for dollar up to $7.5 million, and the fund supports service members, veterans, and their families through recovery, transition, and long-term assistance. And one North Dakota family knows that support firsthand. Their son, their brother, was severely injured in Iraq on Christmas Day in 2023, and the fund has been by their side ever since. The service member's name is Garrett Illebron, and we are honored to be joined by Garrett's sister, Allison Brooks. Allison, thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Of course.
Allison, tell me about your brother, Garrett. What kind of person is he, and what led him to serve?
Well, Garrett tried a couple different things in his younger adult life, and he decided he wanted to be a pilot, so he joined the Army. And he went through all the training. He applied to be an Army Apache pilot several times before he got into school. So we know he is resilient. Being a pilot led him to be a pilot instructor and serving three tours in Iraq. So on his final tour in Iraq, a couple months before he was set to retire in his 20th year of service, there was a drone attack on his base in Iraq. And he unfortunately suffered a head injury that led him to be rushed immediately to Baghdad into surgery, and then from Baghdad to Germany, where he was in the ICU for quite a few weeks. So he's currently recovering in North Carolina, where his wife and son are. He is working hard at rehab, and we're just kind of looking for the next place that he can continue at.
Allison, how did you and your family first learn of his injuries?
We got a phone call from his wife on Christmas Day. She was notified by the Army, his commander. So we had a lot more questions than we had answers, but so a lot of it was by phone. Of course, the timing, Baghdad is like a whole nother day away. So the time change was a challenge, and communicating with the hospital and his wife and all those details was a challenge. But once he got to Germany, his wife was able to meet him over there. And so she was in contact with us more up to date at that time.
Allison, how have these months been since that event, and how's it been for your family?
Well, it was clearly, it was a bit of a shock. And like I said, there was more questions than there were answers, but his wife was with him in Germany. And then once he got to Walter Reed, my family was able to get out there to see him, my parents and myself and his wife. So it's been a lot of up and down, a lot of progress has been made, and then it kind of plateaus and goes up and down, and it waves. And so we don't really know what to expect. We're just kind of taking it as it comes.
Allison, you live here in the Fargo-Moorhead area. How did the Semper Fi Fund and America's Fund step in to help, and what kind of support have they provided you?
As soon as we got to Walter Reed in D.C., they had a representative that was there for us right away, offering us anything we might need. Of course, the question was, what do you guys need? How can we help you? And of course, we had no idea what we needed or how to, navigate. So lucky for us, we had Semper Fi and the fund to kind of tell us what they did and help us find resources and get us out to Washington, D.C., whether it was my family or whoever really wanted to go. They're really good about taking care of the family, so the family can be at the bedside with the injured veteran.
What's that meant to you personally? What has that help meant? And not just financially, but emotionally and spiritually.
Well, it's really comforting to know that, there is somebody there to guide you, and nobody tells you how to do this correctly or what you're supposed to do. We just have to figure it out. And, the fund was there for providing us resources, websites, other family members that have been through an injured family member, an injured veteran. So we were able to make those connections for support. And, somebody that's been through this, somebody, a resource we can ask questions to that's lived it. So, you know, having that support has been huge because nobody knows how to do this. You just wake up and you, like my sister-in-law says, you pay the bills and you empty the dishwasher and you just kind of figure it out.
How's your North Dakota community been, your friends, your neighbors, and others? Have they rallied around your family through all this?
Really, they have. There's, you know, there's always messages, text messages, Facebook messages, asking how he's doing, asking, you know, this time last year during the holidays, they would say, you know, how can we help? How, you know, and so, yeah, he's always in everybody's thoughts and prayers. We come from a small town. Everybody knows him, and, you know, everybody's praying for him, and, you know, they never fail to tell me that. He's always in their thoughts and prayers, and everybody hopes he makes a recovery.
For those who are listening who want to make a difference, what's the best way maybe they can support Garrett and, quite frankly, other families like yours?
The fund is always there to support you and your family whenever you need it, especially, you know, things happen unexpectedly. You don't financially plan for this. You don't emotionally plan for this. But every donation really does make a difference. Every donation at this point is going to be matched up to $7.5 million by the Bob and Renee Parsons Foundation. So every dollar that gets donated, it helps a family directly.
What would your family want us to know about the meaning of Veterans Day today?
It's just the most unbelievable sacrifice somebody can give. I mean, he gave a lot for his country. And every time you see a Vietnam hat or an Army hat on a veteran, just thank them for their service and their sacrifice. If anybody wants to follow along with Garrett's story and his progress, you can follow him on Caring Bridge. It's Garrett Illebrin.
And that's GarrettIllebrunn. The Double Down for Veterans Match campaign runs through December 31st. Every dollar donated to the Semper Fi in America's Fund will be matched, as Allison said, up to $7.5 million by the Bob and Renee Parsons Foundation and Parsons Extreme Golf. You can learn more and make a donation at thefund.org. Allison, thank you so much. And to all who serve and all those who stand beside them for their courage, their strength, and their sacrifice, our thanks for them too. Thanks for being with us today, Allison.
Of course. Thank you.
Support for Pray Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, capturing up to 300 million metric tons of CO2 annually.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is causing severe impacts on indigenous communities in the Pacific. Anita Hofschneider reports on these issues, including sea level rise and fires, for Grist. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Hofschneider about her work.
Can you talk about the ways that climate change is impacting indigenous people in the Pacific that might be a bit different from other indigenous communities on the mainland?
You know, when people think of climate change in the Pacific, the first thing that really comes to mind is sea level rise. And that's true. You know, rising seas are affecting low-lying atolls in places like the Marshall Islands and Tuvalu. But at the same time, it's not just sea level rise. You also have stronger storms that bring heavy rains and landslides in places like Vanuatu. I grew up in the Mariana Islands, and although a lot of people there are used to typhoons, there have been worsening storms and more frequent storms. Another effect is warming waters and the way that the warming waters are bleaching coral reefs and how that affects fish and tourism economies. There's also concern about worsening wildfires, as well as how climate change could affect freshwater availability in the future.
You've done a lot of reporting on the Maui fires, and the fires were 2 years ago, but the impacts are far from over for many families families. Can you tell us about what you've learned families are still dealing with?
So I did a story recently where I interviewed a Native Hawaiian homeowner in Lahaina called Mikey Burke. So Burke was, you know, very lucky to escape with her family, but now she's in the process of trying to rebuild her home and prevent it from going into foreclosure. And so Mikey is trying to hold on to that property so that it can be a place where her children and her children's children can always call home. But it's definitely a very uncertain moment. I did speak with a nonprofit on Maui that was saying that they had dozens of homeowners, 78 homeowners that they worked with, who had missed mortgage payments and were at risk of foreclosure on Maui, largely because they have been trying to pay rent while also waiting to rebuild their homes.
I also wanted to ask about your reporting on the possibility of deep sea mining in the American Samoa. Can you explain the situation there?
So back in April, Trump issued an executive order intended to jumpstart the nascent deep sea mining industry. And the Interior Department launched a process to lease out the seabed surrounding American Samoa. And so what was interesting about this was that the people of American Samoa came out very strongly against deep sea mining. Every single major political leader in American Samoa said no. You know, their economy relies very heavily on fisheries. They're concerned about what the potential impacts might be to their fisheries. And although the company that I spoke with, Impossible Metals, that is, you know, pursuing deep sea mining in their waters, says that their technology would mean there'd be very little environmental harm, the community is still skeptical and is still worried. But what they're finding is that because of their status as a U.S. territory, that compared to other countries in the Pacific that have, you know, independence, they are subject to the U.S. Department of Interior's process, and that is still moving ahead, and it's possible that the mining could take place over their objections.
You report on indigenous stories across the Pacific Islands. What are some of the things that you would want to highlight for our listeners about the region that they might not know?
One thing that your listeners may not necessarily realize is that what happens in the Pacific does affect what happens in the continental U.S. or the Pacific Northwest. You know, when there are typhoons in a place like Guam, or when there are wildfires on Maui, or when atolls are sinking underneath the ocean, and people end up thinking, where do I go? And what does this mean for me and my family? And oftentimes that leads to migration. And so you have growing Pacifica communities in the Pacific Northwest and in the U.S. mainland in general. And so while that is a strength to have more cultural diversity in our communities, it also can be something that evokes a lot of grief among indigenous peoples who are, you know, forced to move somewhere new and aren't able to raise their families in the homes that they have always, the places they have always called home. And so I think that, to me, what that underscores is just how interconnected everything is, that even when climate impacts are being felt very far away, there are additional impacts that kind of reverberate across the country and across the world that really underscore that we should pay attention to this critically important issue.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me. And so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer. That kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
A major world city could run out of water.
That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The COP30 climate conference started in Belém, Brazil last week, drawing tens of thousands of people from around the world. But notably absent are government leaders from the U.S., China, India, and Russia.
Before the meetings began, both the leaders of Chile and Colombia called President Trump a liar At the UN in September, Trump said climate change was the greatest con job ever perpetuated on the world, and earlier this year, he pulled the country out of the Paris Agreement to limit global warming.
California sent a delegation to COP30, including Governor Gavin Newsom. The mayor of Phoenix, Arizona, Kate Gallego, told the audience that 50 U.S. cities were there, committed to ambitious climate action.
Making progress on curbing climate change may be difficult. The UN's yearly report stated that countries are far from meeting the Paris Agreement's goal of limiting warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius by 2100. Most countries have not submitted new plans to decrease emissions.
COP30 is taking place at the edge of the Amazon rainforest, which is at risk from climate change and other threats like deforestation. Belém is at the mouth of the Amazon River and is exposed to rising seas because of its proximity to the ocean. The city was chosen to show world leaders that the crisis must be addressed.
Before the start of the conference, Brazilian officials announced a plan called the Tropical Forest Forever Facility, which would make it more lucrative for nations to protect their forests rather than cutting them down, as trees absorb enormous amounts of greenhouse gases.
However, while Brazil is touting its deforestation efforts, 2 weeks ago the country approved a license for oil drilling near the mouth of the Amazon.
A historic drought in Iran could make its capital city of Tehran reach day zero within about 2 weeks.
Day zero is the term signifying when the main source of drinking water runs dry. As of November 6th, one of five dams that supplies Tehran was only at 8% of its capacity, enough for 2 weeks.
Iran's president reportedly said that if it doesn't rain by late November in Tehran, its 10 million people will have to ration their water. If there's no rain after that, they'll have to evacuate the city.
Mismanagement and overexploitation of water resources, as well as climate change, are said to be the cause of the shortages.
A day zero could occur in other parts of the world, according to a new study by researchers in South Korea.
The authors write that regions along the Mediterranean Sea, parts of North America, and Southern Africa could run out of water as early as this or next decade.
Cape Town, South Africa, faced a complete shutdown of its water in 2018, which was avoided by severe restrictions, like limiting people to just a few liters a day.
The authors say that solutions must come from policymakers prioritizing smart management and modernizing leaky infrastructure, as well as from people using water more responsibly.
And finally, voters in last week's election were energized about their electric bills. Democrats won numerous races in many states, citing spiraling costs and affordability.
In two major contests for governor in New Jersey and Virginia, as well as down-ballot races in Pennsylvania and Georgia, candidates won by tying Republicans to soaring prices.
According to a recent poll, nearly 6 in 10 Americans blame Trump for higher utility bills, which Democrats say is because of his efforts to kill clean energy and shift to more expensive natural gas and coal.
In the past 12 months, electricity costs across the country have risen over 5%, with a portion of that spike due to demand by data centers to power AI.
As the Associated Press reports, projects to modernize the grid against extreme weather and wildfires have added to rate increases, as have Bitcoin miners and a drive to revive domestic manufacturing.
Virginia's governor-elect Abigail Spanberger campaigned on making data centers pay their own way and their fair share of skyrocketing electricity costs. She also promised to speed up clean energy projects.
In New Jersey, where electric prices increased as much as 20% this year, Governor-elect Mikey Sherrill said she would declare a state of emergency and freeze utility bills. She, too, pledged to build more clean energy projects and to work with neighboring states to upgrade the grid to handle and store more power.
Meanwhile, in Georgia, Democrats gained 2 seats on the state's Public Service Commission by pledging to stand up to the state's utility companies, which have raised prices 6 times in the last 2 years.
They also campaigned on expanding low-cost clean energy sources like solar over expensive fossil fuel projects.
In Pennsylvania, Democrats retained 3 state Supreme Court justices to keep the party's 5-2 majority, just as the High Court considers a pending climate case.
If the cost of eggs was the alleged concern for voters in 2024, look for next year's midterms to be electric.
That's it for This Week in Water. H2O Radio's newscast is powered by you, our listeners. Donate at h2oradio.org by December 31st and have your gift doubled.
This is Decoded Datebook for November 11th. Armistice Day was the name of the holiday we now call Veterans Day until 1954, reflecting the date of the armistice with Germany that ended hostilities in World War I in 1918. The Bismarck Tribune published an extra edition announcing the historic end of the war and how quickly the news spread across North Dakota with the banner headline, Peace. By 1920, North Dakota had settled into peacetime, though the legacy of the war still lingered. Adjutant General G.A. Fraser reported 290 U.S. Army deserters in the state from 28 counties. 2 men on the list were arrested, sent to Fort Snelling, Minnesota for court-martial, and sentenced to military prison at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The newspaper stressed that the men have a price on their heads and were being rounded up for military trial as quickly as possible. A few men were mistakenly listed as deserters, and the names were being shared with local American Legion posts to prevent further misidentification. The paper listed the number of deserters by county. Burleigh County had the most at 44, while other counties with significant numbers included Towner, Emmons, Barnes, Foster, Mercer, and Steele County. Despite major cities, neither Cass nor Ward counties had any deserters, and Grand Forks had just 4. Several local papers ran the story statewide. Amid the deserter news, happier headlines highlighted North Dakota National Guard gaining an airplane unit as part of a broader reorganization. The new unit would consist of 1 observation squadron with 31 officers, 132 men, 13 airplanes, and an air park with 3 officers and 172 men. While Armistice Day was a legal holiday, Bismarck held no formal program, instead observing the day at Presbyterian Church on Sunday, November 14th. The state war mother encouraged other war mothers to hold ceremonies across North Dakota between 10:30 and 11 a.m. on the 11th. Various dignitaries spoke in communities, including William Langer in Devil's Lake. Today, Veterans Day is a time for communities, the state, and the nation to honor our living veterans for their service and sacrifice. Take a moment to thank the veterans in your life and consider doing an act of service in your community. Today's Decoded Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwine. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Decoded Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
There's a fight for the future of the Democratic Party, and at its center are young political strategists who want the party to see where it's going wrong.
We would be doing a deep disservice to our party and to the country if we were not looking in the mirror.
We speak to Morris Katz, a strategist behind the historic mayoral win of Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani in New York. He wants to replicate that across the country on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can catch this and all past episodes of Main Street wherever you get your favorite podcasts or at our website at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on the show, in the wake of the federal government shutdowns and Dickinson State University historian Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane joins us to unpack what the shutdown reveals about presidential power in the Trump era. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.